I live here in Highland Park. I've lived here like for 50 years. What's happened, it's something unbelievable.
On a hot day in Los Angeles a few weeks ago, Rosie Cejudo stood in a parking lot near her home to protest. She's 64, wearing a bright yellow blouse, and she and about 100 other residents and business owners in this neighborhood called Highland Park were out on this day to show their concerns about the way rising rents are changing their neighborhood.
Because if you live in an area for 50 years, you see people go and come all the time. It happens, you know, it's normal, you know, in other words. But now you see it so rapidly. I mean, 15 people out in a month, I mean, gone. You never see them again. They close up their doors. You see different people. You know, that's happening.
And that is happening not just in Rosie's neighborhood, but in a bunch of formerly working class neighborhoods and cities around the country.
Yeah, rents are rising, developers and new residents and businesses are moving in, and some longtime residents and businesses are moving out.
Now, Rosie, she owns her own business. It's on wheels. She sells tacos and ceviche out of a bright blue food truck. So for now, at least, she feels a little insulated from the rising rent part. But she's watched lots of her old customers move away.
You remember them every day, you know, every day, every weekend. They're there with the families. The families are gone.
Rosie also worries about how her neighbors are doing, other longtime business owners.
Entrepreneurs who run pupuserias and beauty shops. And she's actually been going door to door, trying to connect them with legal and financial resources and just check in on them. She's heard stories of landlords trying to force tenants out by refusing to fix leaky roofs, of rents doubling and tripling.
And when I went into the businesses, there were people crying. They broke down. Some of them are just packing up and leaving. You know, like in 2 weeks, 30 days. And after 20 years of being there, that's the saddest part. The American dream, it's like for us, it's gone.
Welcome to the latest podcast from the Marketplace Wealth and Poverty Desk. This is the third episode of our mini-series York and Fig, where we've been looking at the forces driving gentrification. I'm Chrissy Clark.
And I'm Caitlin Esch. In past podcasts, we've heard from some of the business owners Rosie's talking about, as well as some of the building owners who see the changes in the neighborhood very differently. You can find all of them at our website, marketplace.org/York and Fig.
So on today's podcast, we're going to look forward at ways that small businesses, local governments, and Fortune 500 companies are responding and adapting to gentrification. And they do it in some really interesting and in some cases, very surreal ways.
The first story you're going to hear about is one store in Highland Park that Chrissy has been fascinated with for a long time now.
It is true. I've been obsessed.
This store has managed to survive and actually thrive in the midst of the change going on around it. Let's take a listen.
The store is called La Tropicana. It's a corner market, signs in the windows for lotto tickets, Western Union money transfers, skinny aisles packed with groceries. And here's a typical line of customers. First, a Latina mom with her two kids buying ingredients for dinner. A bag of dried chili peppers for
$1.49.
The whole transaction done completely in Spanish. Then a tattooed white guy in his 20s.
How are you doing today?
Good. Buying a jug of cold brew coffee and a gourmet deli sandwich.
Totals $18.70.
That whole transaction done completely in English.
Need a receipt?
No, that's okay.
Have a good day.
And that's how it goes. The things people buy, the language they buy them in, tell the story of a neighborhood in transition. Spanish, then English, basics, then indulgences, cheap cat food, Whiskas brand, for $6.99 a bag, then gluten-free cat food.
Gluten-free for your pet. Can you believe that? This is $16.
That's Raina Redfield. She owns La Tropicana, and even she is still a little shocked by some of the new items customers have been requesting. But she says this extreme mix of inventory...
This is a true reflection of what, you know, what the neighborhood is right now.
12 years ago, when Raina first started running this store, this neighborhood looked very different. Most of her customers back then were low-income immigrant families, mostly from Mexico and Central America.
You know, living paycheck to paycheck, depending on food stamps. So we were very, very limited with what we can offer. And, you know, we had to be really conscious of the pricing.
She carried basics: toilet paper, cooking oil, laundry detergent, whatever brand was the cheapest, and low-priced meat and produce that catered to her customers' tastes. Reina was born in Syria, but she grew up in an immigrant neighborhood in L.A. County with lots of Mexican families, and so she sold things she learned about from them. Pig's feet, chicharron, that's fried pig skin, a tropical fruit called chayote,
jicama, yuca,
a cactus called
nopales,
used in salads and juices.
I even learned how to clean the spikes off and cut them up a certain way.
In those days, she was barely breaking even, deeply in debt. Even so, she loved running her business.
I had one young lady who, I think she must have been like 19 or 20, come to me and say, you know, thank you for investing here. Nobody ever wanted to invest in our neighborhood, and you really bring us things that we need, and I really appreciate it. And the connection that I have been able to make with people here in the community and the friendships that I've built, I don't know, it's really special.
But then, about 5 years ago, customers started asking her two questions she was not prepared for. Some of her regular customers came in to
ask for boxes
because they told her they were moving out of the neighborhood. Meanwhile, some new faces started showing up in the store.
Instead of people asking for a product that would be used to prepare Mexican cuisine, people were asking for something completely different. Organic milk, organic eggs, you know, gluten-free bread.
Back then, Reina had not heard of the word gentrification. And then when she did hear people start using it, she didn't know what it meant.
I had to go Google it. But before even that word would come up, I noticed that my customers are asking for different things, and they look different, and they spoke better English.
Reina says she doesn't want to label her customers or judge them. She wants La Tropicana to be welcoming for all: Spanish speakers, English speakers, buyers of whiskas, and gluten-free cat food.
They're, you know, supporting me and my employees, and we go home without them, regardless of who they are.
When you hear about old mom-and-pop stores closing down and gentrifying neighborhoods, there's often this talk about how they just couldn't change with the times. But it's not that simple. I've interviewed lots of longtime shop owners that lost their businesses, and like Reina, they wanted to change with the times. But many of them lacked two important things that Reina has. First of all, a long-term lease on their building. Because Reina does have this, she doesn't have to worry about her rent rising all of a sudden. The second thing that's given Reina a huge advantage: luck. Really good luck.
Good luck, California, and here are tonight's winning numbers.
I was literally in bed, and I get a text message from one of my employees.
Followed by 9.
And the only thing in the text message was just the word in capital letters, just the word boss.
And our final number.
Reina called her employee, and he told her their store had just sold a lotto ticket that won an $8 million jackpot. The way the lotto works in California, Reina's store got a $40,000 cut of the winnings. Now, this was 5 years ago, in the depths of a recession that many stores in the neighborhood are still reeling from. And if not for her crazy stroke of luck, Reina says La Tropicana might be in the same boat.
Seriously, we would not be here today without that lotto ticket. A week or two before that happened, I was just kind of given up. You know, I knew that I didn't have the cash flow to keep going. I couldn't get any loans. I didn't have any collateral. And then I started shifting into, how am I going to tell my girls that I'm going to be letting them go?
But after the lotto jackpot, she didn't have to let them go. She used the $40,000 to pay off most of her debts, which gave her the breathing room to plan strategically and change with the times. Today, La Tropicana has become a gathering place for her old customers and her new ones, with an espresso bar, a juice bar, a super popular deli counter.
We're just welcoming, period. Like, it doesn't really matter who's coming in that door.
And everyone I talk to inside and outside the store seems to agree.
Do you come here often?
Too often. The sandwiches are great.
Feels like you're going somewhere from different, like you're out of whatever city you're living in.
Ever since I started here, I've made a big change in the neighborhood.
There's something about it that has that, like, neighborhood originality about it.
But Reina also sees this tension between accommodating the changes in her new customer base and not alienating the longtime customers that have supported her business since the beginning. She told me that those cactus that she learned to despike for her customers long ago, the nopales, well, a few weeks ago, she stopped selling them. Reina's dad, who helps her out buying produce, had been warning her for months that they'd gone from selling two or three cases of nopales a week when they first opened the store to now less than half of a single case. The rest was just rotting on the shelf.
I fought it for a long time. What do you mean we're not going to sell nopales anymore? Seriously? We've always sold nopales. For a long time, I fought it. And then when he showed me the numbers, I thought, okay, Dad, all right, fine. Let's just stop selling nopales.
Was there something sad about that? Was there, did you?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I knew that certain customers did come in for it. And if they're here in the community, I want to be able to service them. But I had to think of it in a different way as a business. You know, it doesn't make sense for me to carry a product or buy something and then toss it in the trash.
And it's not just nopales. Over the last few years, after looking at declining sales, Reina has stopped selling chayote and pig's feet and yuca. One day, I met a man in front of La Tropicana who's lived in the neighborhood 38 years. He passes the store every day. He says he likes the way it's been upgraded lately.
Más elegante,
more elegant, much nicer. But he says he doesn't shop there anymore.
No, ahorita no, porque ya no vende este chicharrón.
They stopped selling chicharrón, he says. So there's not much left there for him anymore.
You could do the laundry. I'll come by on Monday. You give me the money. I will buy a ticket on the local lottery. We could win the lottery.
Okay, so Chrissy was telling the story about La Tropicana to a guy in San Francisco recently, where there are lots of neighborhoods going through the same exact kinds of dramatic changes.
We're looking at you, Mission District.
And this funny thing happened, right, Chrissy, where you got to the part in the story about how the store was saved by winning the lottery. And the guy you're telling the story to lets out this peal of laughter.
Oh, my God. Well, it's the sad state of affairs that you need to win the lottery as a business to be able to survive. That's sad.
This guy I was talking to was an official sort of guy. His name is David Campos, and he represents the Mission and nearby neighborhoods on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. He's been proposing a lot of new policies lately to try to respond to gentrification in his city. One of them's gotten a lot of press. It's about putting a temporary moratorium on building any market-rate housing in the Mission. But the one proposal that I wanted to talk to him about has gotten less attention. It's a plan to help some old businesses survive gentrification, even if they don't hit the lotto jackpot. He calls it the Legacy Business Historic Preservation Fund, and it's on the November ballot in San Francisco. I asked him to explain how the fund would work.
Sure. So the fund does two things. One, it provides an annual grant to a legacy business based on the number of employees that they have, and it's $500 per employee with a limit of 100 employees. So for some of these businesses, it can be as much as $50,000, which we believe can make a difference. And then the second piece is to address the issue that is hurting so many of these businesses, which is that there are rising commercial rents. There is no commercial rent control in California. And these businesses are having a hard time compete with these other companies that want to come in and they're willing to pay a lot more in rent. So what we're doing is we're providing a grant to the property owner that chooses to actually give that legacy business a long-term lease.
Paint a bit of a picture of why San Francisco might need something like this. Like, how big is the problem?
In 1992, there were about 500 businesses that were going out of business. That number has progressively increased to the point that in 2014, we saw, you know, tremendous turnover. We had more than 4,000 small businesses that went out of business in San Francisco. In my district, you know, we have lost the Lexington Esta Noche. Esta Noche was, you know, a long-standing gay Latino bar. Right now, because it went out of business, there is no such establishment in the city. In Chinatown, we have the Empress of China, a Chinese restaurant that went out of business. And there are so many that are struggling, and we don't want to lose that. And the way it works right now is that these businesses are on their own.
On the other side, some people would say, you know, business is business, and businesses exist as long as they're relevant. Mm-hmm. And then if they can't compete with sort of the changing marketplace and the higher rents, maybe it shouldn't be in business anymore. Maybe that means that its use or its value is has gone away. So what do you say to kind of that mode of thinking or that approach?
The focus of this program is on businesses that are legacy business that by virtue of being a legacy business have been successful. These are businesses that have been around 30 more years. And what we're finding is that even though these businesses have been successful and they have a formula that has worked for them, that there is something unique about the real estate market in San Francisco right now that even successful businesses are struggling. And let's be clear, the city has also played a role in creating the situation that we have in San Francisco. The city at some point made a choice to invest in the tech sector, for instance, in attracting these tech companies by giving them pretty generous tax breaks. And you know what? You know, we wanted those companies to be here, and the city made that choice. And if we're willing to make that choice for these big corporations, why wouldn't we step in and make that similar choice for the mom and pop stores that are key to, you know, who we are as a city?
Well, Supervisor Campos, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me.
Thank you for talking and covering this very important issue.
So David Campos mentioned the tax breaks that big corporations like Twitter have gotten to set up shop in San Francisco, and they've brought a lot of jobs to areas that were once disinvested. But at the same time, they've also driven gentrification in those areas. So this last story is about another way big corporations figure into gentrifying neighborhoods.
Right. Specifically, we're talking about big box stores that have spent the last few decades out in the suburbs. And now they're realizing that actually these old inner city urban core areas have been transforming, and there are these consumer havens now. And so these companies are trying to figure out how they can get a piece of that action.
In fact, there are special guided bus tours that big companies will take you on through these gentrifying neighborhoods. And Chrissy, you actually went on one of those tours recently, didn't you?
Yes, a bus tour. And they're a little bit strange because, of course, these places are full of tension and the drama of people losing their homes and their businesses. But the bus tour is not there to focus on that stuff. It is all about the business opportunities.
Okay, let's hear the piece.
All right, everybody, on your magical mystery tour.
I'm sitting in a pleasantly air-conditioned charter bus, surrounded by lots of polo shirts and button-downs and other forms of corporate casual.
You guys also have sunscreen if anyone wants any.
Worn by members of the upper management team from Lowe's. You know, the big box home improvement chain.
I'm the chief supply chain officer.
Director in marketing consumer insights.
General merchandising manager for seasonal.
All these people, and about a dozen more like them, have just flown to Los Angeles from Lowe's headquarters outside Charlotte, North Carolina, so they can get on this bus, where, at the moment, we are driving down a potholed, not very picturesque street. Everybody's necks are craned toward the windows. They've been told to keep their eye out for something. And soon enough, they spot it. A black building with the name Habitat painted in big white letters.
Where is it?
Habitat.
Habitat.
Habitat is a new coffee shop in the area. But for the purposes of this bus tour, it is so much more than that. It is a sign that this urban working-class neighborhood we're driving through is on its way to becoming cool. And why do a bunch of suburban box store executives care about urban cool? Well, here's one of my busmates, Tanya Franklin, Lowe's Director of Market and Consumer Insights.
Last fall, actually all of last year, we were trying to
really reevaluates how we look at consumer trends and just some of the shifts taking place among consumers, not just how they shop, but also how they live.
And more to the point, where they live, because recently it's been changing.
People moving back into the city, inner city rings are really evolving.
For years, inner city rings did not show up on the radar of a mass retail giant like Lowe's. The suburbs, big generic shopping malls, those were the best bets for finding lots of customers with money to spend. But the suburbs are getting poorer. And that holy grail of retail demographics, the millennials, they are flocking to gentrifying neighborhoods like this one that we're driving through right now. Leaders at Lowe's realized they needed to get a better handle on what makes this new generation tick, which is why they're on this bus.
All right, guys, so take notes, please, so we can relay our experiences to the other team.
The guy helping the Lowe's team get a handle on this is Stefan Paskalidis. He's sitting at the front of the bus, pointing out the window at what, to an untrained eye, might just look like a fairly rundown urban street. But Paskalidis is helping his passengers see it differently.
So, guys, this is an interesting mix of the old and new with, you know, two juice shops. So, you know, it's gentrified when there's two juice shops.
Paskalidis calls himself a cultural insights consultant. His company, Now Plus One, takes big corporate brands, Clorox, Frito-Lay, and today, Lowe's, on tours like this one. He calls them insight immersions.
Think of us as storytellers slash translators slash guides.
Each tour for each client has a specific theme. He's done the concept of masculinity for Pepsi, the concept of realness for Purina, and then there's this Lowe's tour, all about the changing demographic landscape.
So you'd recommend I'm going to get the banh mi because I love a good banh mi.
We stop for lunch in one of the hottest urban neighborhoods in L.A. these days, Highland Park, at a restaurant called Good Girl Dinette. It's got a shiny orange counter and exposed brick walls. Paskalidis describes the place as comfort food with Vietnamese flair.
So, guys, sorry, may I have your attention?
This place, Paskalidis tells his group, reflects what he calls the cultural hybridity of Southern California. And then he explains what a banh mi sandwich is. The manager of the restaurant comes over, a young guy with a beard, and Paskalidis takes the opportunity to mine him for information.
I just wanted him to tell us a little bit about this place and the neighborhood and the kind of folks who patronize this place.
It's a wonderful smattering of people that have lived here since before any of us were born, and then newbies like me who just moved to the neighborhood and just are yearning for something that feels like kind of real and sincere and this is, like, as real as you can get.
One of the Lowe's executives jots down real in his notebook. They got handed out at the beginning of the tour with a list of questions to consider for each stop along the way. Like, what role does comfort food play in an urban environment? What about the restaurant's aesthetic communicates its culinary intent?
Okay, so what do you write here?
Troy Daly, a senior vice president at Lowe's, let me look at his notes.
I was just talking about eclectic food combination. He was talking about a lot of artsy folks come in, and so the vegetarian and vegan was the selection that really thought brought those in.
Daly says it's not like Lowe's is planning on suddenly getting into the food business or anything.
From my standpoint, it's really getting to understand the customer outside of our world.
After the restaurant, we get back on the bus.
Why are you walking this slow for there?
Most of the team agrees the banh mi sandwiches were delicious, though.
A lot of garlic.
The tour lasts 8 hours. We go to a DIY woodworking shop where they teach people how to make their own wooden spoons.
You can kind of feel here, those are the tool paths that are left by the mill.
We stop by a new condo development that Paskalidis explains is redefining the concept of community space.
I know you guys have some unique things, including a private dog park and a vegetable patch. Is that correct?
At the stop where we meet a successful real estate guy who tours us through a house he's just flipped.
Steve is one of the sort of real estate innovators in this area.
It's all about
authenticity and integrity. Authenticity and integrity. Does that make sense?
Authenticity,
so in the homes that we do, so I use, like, the nice materials. We use the marble. We use the nice hardwood floors.
By the end of the bus tour, our heads are buzzing with buzzwords meant to evoke what the 21st century urban consumer wants. Some folks are stealing naps at the back of the bus. At one point, we drive down another street in what may or may not be an up-and-coming neighborhood, and Lowe's chief supply chain officer, Steve Salaji, pipes up.
Saw a yogurt shop back there.
Yogurt shop.
A for effort, but the yogurt trend is kind of over.
That's it for our podcast today. The York and Fig podcasts have been produced by me, Caitlin Esch. Daniel Ramirez is the engineer. Nancy Fargali is the senior editor. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer of Marketplace.
Thanks to Shayna Deloria and Daisy Palacios for additional reporting. I'm Chrissy Clark. Oh, and if you like this podcast, help us do more of them by giving us a glowing review on iTunes. Okay, and we also just wanted to leave you with a little collection of pieces of tape that we've been gathering. Because whenever the subject of gentrification comes up, it provokes, let's say, colorful responses. So here are a few from our months of reporting in Highland Park.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. Is there anything you're going to add?
Anything? Like,
anything.
All right, well, fuck gentrification.
You could say that. Gentrification, is that what it is? Economically, it's working for us.
I do not like the word gentrification. I prefer the word transformation.
This is APM.